Hello and welcome to the Mindfulness Medicine Certification Program webinar. This is Thursday, July 11th, 2019, and we have some great questions to dig into. Of course, if you have any questions you want to submit live, please use the Q&A box to submit those questions rather than the chat. That's more helpful for being able to see and answer those as we go along here. So before diving into some of the questions, I would like to share a bit about a case that we have in the clinic and an update on that case. So we have a case where someone has come in. He was on a steroid for an oral steroid for his asthma, as well as a rescue inhaler. He also had more weight on him than he would like. He was also experiencing some digestive issues, and he was coming to try to really just get his lifestyle in check and see if he could get off of some of the medications, and his blood pressure was creeping up. And when we did his labs, what we found is that we found some inflammatory marker elevations. We found a susceptibility to mold and mold toxin. And we found that in the nutrition and lifestyle assessment that there were some things that were getting in the way. So we asked him to eliminate alcohol for a period and then moderate it after that. We went through an elimination diet that was an AIP diet, so it eliminated all grains, dairy, legumes, sugar, refined foods, processed foods, nuts, seeds, nightshade vegetables. And we did that for 60 days, and then we started reintroducing things. In that process, he noticed that his seasonal allergies went away. We hadn't even talked about seasonal allergies for him, but he noticed they went away. And we added supplements in for dealing with small intestinal bacterial overgrowth that we found on labs, a methylation issue that we found from high homocysteine, and with a few other things that we found on some of the blood work. And in, I think it's been about 6 months now, and he has lost 40 pounds. He's off the oral steroid. He's only used his rescue inhaler twice in the past 6 months. He's now feeling like his digestion is just about perfect. He didn't know that that level of stool could, you know, be coming out of him. And he also has told me that he's feeling better than he has felt since he was 22 years old. So I wanted to just share that success story as a way to understand the power of the medicine that we're all doing here. I did not have a chance to gather his labs all together, but I may make a more comprehensive case study about this in the future with labs and protocols to show you a little more specifics here. And so now let's get started on questions. So we have one question here from Annette, and that's, do diet sodas interfere with downregulating the MMC? So the MMC, or the migrating motor complex, is that flushing mechanism that's the function where the small intestine's flushing out debris, fiber, bacteria, etc. When that function is having a problem, we often see that being one of the main root causes for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So we want to make sure that it's functioning properly, and we want to avoid things that are downregulating the MMC, and we want to add things that are prokinetics or that are stimulating migrating motor complex activity. And diet sodas, I don't know of any research directly linking them to a downregulation of the migrating motor complex. Diet sodas are going to contain alternative sweeteners, and some of those alternative sweeteners do horrible things. Others of them are less problematic. So for example, when I'm at a client recently and she was having multiple diet sodas every day, and she was having regular old Diet Coke was her thing. So I asked her to switch to Zevia, and Zevia is a still carbonated cola beverage, which isn't ideal. It still has caffeine, and it is, but it's sweetened with stevia instead of aspartame or, you know, whichever other sweetener, depending on which diet beverage. And that was a significant improvement, because we take one step, loosen the habit a bit with something that still satisfies some of those underlying desires, and then we can take a next step with starting to change that to green tea to get that caffeine content, but without the bubbly, fizzy, sweet flavor. And that process is a nice way to give a step down and another step down. So that's something that we did recently for someone who was drinking diet sodas. In general, what I say with diet sodas is, although I don't see direct research about the MMC, and it may be there, I just haven't seen it, I've seen enough research about aspartame disrupting the microbiome that I am very, very strongly encouraging getting off of diet soda, but sometimes in that step-by-step process. So for overall gut health, for SIBO, for anything where we're trying to restore a healthy microbiota, I strongly recommend the reduction or elimination of diet sodas. The other thing that some people have, and it's about one third of people, have a bacterial population that tends to have this response to alternative sweeteners that is making it so that the alternative sweetener itself doesn't trigger blood sugar spikes, but with a certain microbiota population, what happens is that when someone has an alternative sweetener, that when they have regular sugar later, even if it's natural like fruit sugar, that will trigger an elevated blood sugar response from having had the alternative sweetener previously. So it's essentially like the normal blood sugar response to carbohydrates and natural sugars gets amplified in someone who has this particular microbiota makeup, and it's about one third of people. And I don't know a great test to assess that for sure. I know there is some testing that can give a sense of that, but for now what I do is just, I caution people with alternative sweeteners. If we switch to something like stevia, I will want to do a blood sugar panel after a couple of months to see if a person is having an elevated blood sugar response to normal things. And if they are, I will recommend they get off of even the natural alternative sweeteners like stevia. So that is one that depends. But stevia is great for certain things, like it can really help with Lyme treatment, because stevia breaks down biofilm for Lyme. So there are some studies showing that stevia can be helpful in treatment of Lyme. So we do use stevia as treatment. And I do think stevia in general for most people are fine, but there may be a third of people who might have some problem with alternative sweeteners in general, and that may include stevia. So I tend to monitor blood sugar responses, get a baseline before they go on to alternative sweeteners if they're not already doing alternative sweeteners, and then get a follow-up blood sugar panel after they've been on alternative sweeteners. And if they have already been on alternative sweeteners, I may either want them to come off entirely so that we can look at blood sugar and see where it's at, or if they're on a lot of regular sugar and alternative sweeteners, we'll just go off of regular sugar, see where that follow-up blood sugar is still high, go off of alternative sweeteners, and then retest and see where that blood sugar and fasting insulin and hemoglobin A1C and fructosamine are at. So, oh, and comment of liking to include tea also. Yes. So I don't see any problems with green tea or even coffee necessarily with the migrating motor complex. So switching to green tea and or coffee may be helpful for some individuals from something like diet soda to get some of that caffeine boost and some beverage that they enjoy. And not everyone tolerates tea or coffee, so that's its own question and analysis based on HPA axis and based on several other elements and variables. So kind of it depends as to whether someone tolerates that, but a lot of people do, and if they do, then that can be just fine. What I'm going to do now is I am going to share screen for some of the questions. So here we have a question, 72-year-old female client having knee replacement surgery in October. We're working on many issues with her, macular degeneration, gut issues, SIBO, high NAGLase, stealth viral infection, iron deficiency anemia, hypertension. She's taking a large number of supplements. The question is, what supplements, if any, should she come off of prior to surgery? Just wondering if any herbs / supplements are contraindicated before surgery. It's a long list that she's taking. B-complex, potassium, lutein, zeaxanthin, C, E, zinc, copper, adrenamin, which is an adrenal support, magnesium, iron, B12, probiotics, digestive enzymes, HCL-betaine, quercetin, mangista, and CUCBO, which is an herbal combination that we produce here at Living Love. And she is rotating artemisinin, myrrh, echinacea, St. John's wort, and Vironon, which is another MediHerb process for the virus. Thinking we should be conservative and take her off everything 10 days before surgery. What do you recommend in this case? Anything that she absolutely must not take before surgery. So when we have a question like this about surgery, there are several things to keep in mind. There's risk tolerance because every practitioner and every client has their own level of risk tolerance in terms of, regardless of what research says, regardless of what an idea about what might be useful and not useful, regardless of any of that, there are going to be some things that are going to be considerations. And some of those things are simply risk tolerance for litigation. If something went wrong in the surgery and they were on a supplement, regardless of whether the supplement contributed in any way or had any research that it could contribute in any way, there could be some action against a practitioner, which is an unfortunate truth. So that's just something to consider, your own risk tolerance. Consider the risk tolerance of your client. And that is something that I recommend everyone do for themselves and ask the client to do for themselves in a situation like what to go off of before surgery. And then it's good to document that you at least gave the you gave a recommendation to go off of everything 10 days before, and you also gave which ones have research so that the person can make their own informed choice if they decide to stay on some. So that's one way to handle a situation like this. So some of the things that are helpful to avoid during surgery are going to be, I'm going to open up a list here. So let's get a blank document. Sharing screen here. Okay, we'll just go on a whiteboard here. So one of the big things to look at with what to avoid prior to surgery is going to be things that have effects on blood thinning, because when there's a surgical procedure, there's usually cutting involved and bleeding is common. And then there needs to be the clotting, the proper clotting formation post-surgery in order for recovery. So because of that, we want to avoid a certain list of things that can have blood thinning properties to them. So here's a partial list here. So what we've got is on the blood thinning side, we have vitamin E, we have fish oil and omega-3, we have garlic, we have red chili pepper, ginkgo biloba, saw palmetto, ginseng, chondroitin and glucosamine, bromelain, arnica, ginger, licorice. We have oil of wintergreen, feverfew, devil's claw, seasonal tonic tea, Japanese honeysuckle, Baikal skullcap root, fritillaria bulbs, Tog gastronal tea, Pone citron or jishi, Don Shen, which is a Chinese herb, which is salvia root. Guiling jiao is a tortoise jelly. It's not used much these days. That's a Chinese herb. Chinese agrimony, Chinese peony is used in a reasonable number of Chinese formulas. Geum japonicum, and I'm not pronouncing all these correct, but you'll get the sense. And Kangen Karyu Bokfung pill. So these are all things that have some research or some possibility of having an anticoagulation effect. And we want to avoid anticoagulation effects for prior to surgery by at least 10 days. And so these are things to avoid for 10 to 14 days prior to surgery. Now, some of these things you'll notice are in foods, and if you get a little bit of chili pepper or some garlic in food, if it's a small amount, I don't worry about it, and I don't think most surgeons worry about it. So, of course, if a person's surgeon tells them to avoid garlic or avoid chili pepper, they should follow that instruction. I'm not necessarily going to be telling a person to be strict about that, but I'll let people know not to supplement with a supplement that's high in garlic, not to try to take extra garlic, not to try to put extra chili pepper on things so that they're avoiding those things. So you have to look at ingredients to know what things have some of these in them. So unfortunately, a lot of herbal formulations have a little bit of licorice, especially Chinese herbal formulations. So that knocks a lot off the list just to be extra safe. Most of them have such a small amount of licorice, it probably wouldn't make a difference. But again, want to be conservative, especially in the case of surgery. So we might have them come off of many herbal formulas due to this. There are a couple of other considerations aside from things that are related to blood thinning. So one thing to consider is and by the way, this list is from the Aesthetic Surgery Journal, Volume 32, Issue 3, in the American Society for Aesthetic Plastic Surgery. So this is a list from that journal. So it is a research-based list. Then we have an article in JAMA, the Journal of American Medical Association, and this article looks at kava root, St. John's wort, and valerian that may have some interference as well in some of the anesthesia, if anesthesia is being used. So especially kava and valerian. And then St. John's wort has a lot of interference with drugs and the metabolism of drugs and impacts that. So because of that, often it's also recommended that St. John's wort be eliminated and gone off of prior to a surgical procedure. So definitely want to go off of anything with kava, St. John's wort, or we have kava, valerian, and St. John's wort. And St. John's wort is more about the drug interactions, and then kava and valerian are more about the anesthesia interaction. If someone's not, if they're doing a surgical procedure, not under anesthesia, then these would be potentially not as important. Then we have the American Society of Anesthesiologists, and they add ephedra, which is a Chinese herb, but it's been banned from the US for many years, so people usually aren't going to have it unless they have some specific reason to have it, or unless they've had some Chinese herbalist who's been able to get a hold of it and is using it, which is pretty rare. It's a great herb for asthma. I think it's really it shouldn't be banned in the context of a well-trained Chinese herbalist who knows what they're doing with it, but it is. So that's usually not so much of a concern. Then we have ginseng, which we already listed in the ones that can affect coagulation or, you know, blood thinning. So ginseng, garlic, and vitamin E, ginseng has a potential to increase heart rate and plus the bleeding concern. Then garlic can lower blood pressure. So that's the main concern with garlic, and vitamin E could have anticoagulation and or blood pressure issue. So these are just some of the known examples, and these are some of the main ones that have been researched. Now, when we look at positive research and we see, well, what things have been positively researched in relation to surgery? So in terms of positive research for cardiac surgeries, vitamin C has been recommended at 2 grams day before surgery, then 1 gram day of, and for at least 5 days after. But I say for at least 7 days, for a week. So that would be 2 grams day of, 1 gram per day for at least 7 days. Now, that's recommended in the research for cardiac surgery. There aren't any significant, that I'm aware of, contraindications for other surgeries, so I tend to think that it's probably okay to use vitamin C in the case of other surgeries as well. So vitamin C would be one to consider with relation to surgery. Now, if someone's not on a blood thinner that the mechanism of action is related to vitamin K, then post-surgery, there are some things that can be helpful, including vitamin K. And K2 especially is potentially helpful with repairing some of the tissue, and so that is something that I think is worth considering as well. When looking at what to do after surgery. I like a mix of types of K2, an MK4, MK7 mix would be ideal. Not quite necessary, but it would be ideal if that could happen. So that's something to consider. And then one other comment on vitamin C is the antioxidative properties are part of the mechanism behind which it might be helpful. And it is potentially, there could be a complication with weight reduction surgeries like gastric bypass in one Cleveland Clinic article. So that's, but gastric bypass may be an exception for the vitamin C thing, just because of kidney stones following the surgery as a risk in that particular surgery. I'm not sure that it would be a significant risk, but I think it's worth noting. Then there's other things that can be potentially helpful post-surgery. Aside from vitamin K, both 1 and 2. Are going to be vitamin B12. Vitamin B12 is, of course, important for many functions in the body. It is important for energy, it's important for nerve function. And so it's one that I really like to make sure gets included. It has this neurologic impact. It has impact on DNA synthesis. And so it would be one to also, it's so involved in red blood cell formation that I think it's one to really consider including post-surgery, especially if there's any thought of deficiency, but even if there's not, vitamin B12 would be a good post-surgical option. Then we have magnesium, which is also involved with DNA. It's also involved with so many functions in the body. So the healing process of the body, magnesium is really, really helpful. And zinc. So zinc, of course, is also involved with DNA, and it's the synthesis of DNA and cell division. So these are important processes post-surgery. So magnesium and zinc would be important nutrients to make sure are in reasonably high quantities post-surgery. So 400 to 600 milligrams per day of magnesium glycinate and zinc, either glycinate or citrate or malate would be helpful at about 15 milligrams. So that would be a nice post-surgery stack as well. So another post-surgery thing that can be helpful is making sure vitamin D status is optimal, and if not, optimizing vitamin D status and adding maybe even some higher dose vitamin C post-surgery. So that can be helpful as well. And then if there is a tendency towards anemia, iron may be helpful. So Those are all post-surgical things. So then one other thing prior to surgery is that prior to surgery, we want to also consider certain teas, like hibiscus tea, which can lower blood pressure. We may not want to alter blood pressure, so it would be helpful to avoid hibiscus. We may also want to avoid caffeinated beverages for 24 or even 48 or 72 hours prior to surgery. That is, turmeric or curcumin is a mixed bag. It's probably okay before surgery, but there's a little bit of anticoagulation research. It's really, really small and controversial. So I'm not sure if it really needs to be, but to be cautious, we can eliminate curcumin or turmeric prior to surgery if we want to be more cautious. But post-surgery, it would be really, really helpful. So other things post-surgery here. Let's move this up. So we have curcumin. We have systematic enzymes, or systemic, I mean. These are the proteolytic enzymes that are used on an empty stomach that can reduce inflammation and probably help the healing process. So these would be, there are a lot of companies make a proteolytic enzyme mix or a systemic enzyme mix, or Wobenzyme is another one. So, you know, it's things like bromelain in high quantities and a few others. You wouldn't want to do that prior to surgery, but you could do that post-surgery and it could be really helpful. And then whey protein. Whey protein, because whey protein has a lot of the amino acids that are precursors to glutathione. So it's going to be helpful with increasing that master antioxidant in the body and help with the oxidative stress. It's also going to give the building blocks for building back muscle. There might be a period of sedentary or more sedentary rest post-surgery typically, and there could be some breakdown of tissue. So it's helpful to have those building blocks. So having whey protein, maybe at least, you know, 20 grams a day, but even 30 or 40 grams a day for a week prior to surgery, or sorry, post-surgery, can be very helpful. So whey protein would be something to consider. And then collagen protein, because collagen protein is going to have a lot of glycine. And glycine as an amino acid is helpful with detoxification. It's also helpful with being able to build collagen, build connective tissue. And there, again, may be some tissue repair needed. So collagen protein would be another thing to add, or if not collagen protein, then glycine is an amino acid post-surgery. So wrapping up this surgery conversation, it may be helpful to eliminate all things that are herbs, vitamins, minerals prior to surgery. That would be sort of a safe bet, and it will be something that you can, depending on your risk tolerance and the client risk tolerance, you could say, hey, do 10 days before or 14 days before, no supplements, no herbs, vitamins, minerals, just, you know, eat a clean, healthy diet. Then during surgery, you can use vitamin C, especially on cardiac surgeries, and if it's not gastric bypass surgery, you could do vitamin C prior to surgery as an exception as well, if you wanted. Post-surgery, you can add vitamin C, vitamin K and K2, B12, magnesium, zinc, vitamin D, and iron if there's a tendency towards anemia, curcumin, turmeric, systemic enzymes, whey protein, collagen protein, if you're playing the less conservative role, then you can simply go off of the ones that are on the list. So no Cava Valerian, St. John's Wort, and then the big list of the ones that have some blood thinning effects, avoiding all of those for the 10 to 14 days prior, but maybe staying on a few others. So maybe staying on a B complex and a multi-mineral and maybe, you know, some sort of basic things along those lines. So that would be a less conservative option. But of course, it would be helpful to chart in your chart note and let the person know that they, of course, you do have to recommend that they follow the instructions of the surgeon, and that's for a good reason. The surgeon may have some knowledge about the particular kind of surgery and, for example, the very specific needs in gastric bypass surgery that are a little different than other surgeries. So do make sure to chart that and let people know about that. So that is a wrap on the process of the surgery and what to do for someone who's going into surgery in terms of supplements, vitamins, minerals, herbs, pre and post. So hope this is helpful to you. And let's just get this is... I'll just get a little notes here, make it clear. Okie doke. So let's go on to the next. Question. So we have a female, age 32, so early 30s, familial high cholesterol, so familial hypercholesterolemia is probably what's going on here, for which she doesn't want to take statin drugs. Signs and symptoms. This client came to me curious about alternatives for high cholesterol. She has always had cholesterol that was above 200 as a child and above 300 as an adult. As a child, she was diagnosed with familial hypercholesterolemia, or FM for short. Her mom had the same high cholesterol as a child and young woman, and she started taking statins in her 30s. She never had a heart attack or any heart issues until recently, when they've noticed more clotting than they would like to see. My client said this made her a bit more nervous about her own high cholesterol. Her mom's dad and brother died of heart attacks at 41 and 50. They were also both severe alcoholics, one of them also did drugs. The client is from a family of five kids, and along with her one brother have had, along with one brother have had high cholesterol since childhood. This client was on a statin drug at one time, said she didn't feel like it was the right approach for her to take it. She's grateful she stopped because she went on to have four kids and they're all healthy. She just finished nursing her youngest child and is not planning to have more kids. First recommendation was to get new blood work through her primary care to get a baseline for how things are looking now that she's no longer nursing. We have most of the labs back, and we're going to take a look at those in a moment. She's been focusing on her diet for a number of years now, eating a healthy whole foods Mediterranean-type diet. She's very involved in energy work and spiritual approaches to health and wellness. She said she's mostly approached this issue from an energetic mindfulness standpoint, along with a mostly healthy diet. Now she wants to make sure she's making responsible decisions regarding not taking that medication and what she could alternately be doing supplementally. First time dealing with this, has all her doctors pressuring her to take meds, love our input on this case. HDL is low, ferritin's low, homocysteine high, vitamin D functionally low. Still waiting on ApoB, ApoE, SDL, DL, and a few others. I know these labs will provide a lot more important info, and any thoughts on how to figure these labs when they do come back would be very helpful. Other labs we'd recommend later. So let's take a look at the lab results here. Okay, so we have fasting insulin at 5.0. That's great. 2 to 5 is a really great place for fasting insulin to be, so I like it at 5.0. So from that perspective, blood sugar looks good. I don't see glucose, hemoglobin A1C here, so we don't know that. Not sure if we got that or not, but we'll see. So first we have insulin. That looks great. Now we have cholesterol total is 298. HDL cholesterol is 45. Triglycerides are 83. I like to see triglycerides less than 100, so that's great for triglycerides. LDL cholesterol is 233. Ferritin is 12. With a total iron of 131, iron binding set capacity of 393, and percent saturation of 33. So, starting with what we have here. Okay, homocysteine high, carbon dioxide low. TSH normal. So one of the things I think immediately when someone's presenting with something like familial hypercholesterolemia is if they've already got the diagnosis, great. If they don't, the Simon Broome's Simon Broome criteria is a great one to look at. So if you look at the Simon Broome diagnostic, you're going to see that you can do something like this. Put 298 for total, 233 for LDL. And then it asks, are there tendon xanthomas? So you might palpate along the Achilles and see if you feel nodules. If you feel nodules, you will say, yes, there are tendon xanthomas. That's going to change it from unlikely that there's familial hypercholesterolemia to definite. So tendon xanthomas are one big sign of familial hypercholesterolemia. Now, is there DNA-based evidence of a functional LDLR, PCSK9, and ApoB mutation? If yes, then that also makes it definite. So, of course, if we have DNA evidence, family history of premature cardiovascular events. Now, in this case, I don't know if they're tendon xanthomas. I don't know if there's DNA evidence. I guess there might be if there's been the diagnosis, but we do know there's family history of premature cardiovascular events. And so we know that in a first degree relative less than 60 years old. Family history of extremely high cholesterol, yes. So we have now a probable for familial hypercholesterolemia with the Simon Broome criteria. If we palpated tendon xanthomas, it would turn into a definite. If we had DNA evidence, that would turn into a definite. So that's something to take into consideration when you're considering whether, if someone doesn't come to you already saying they have familial hypercholesterolemia, but they're having a cholesterol that's approaching 300, then you might take a look at this as a way to get a good sense for what might be going on. So that's one. Now, another thing I'm going to think of, well, you know, is there a metabolic issue? There can be a connection between metabolic issues and cholesterol issues. In this case, there's not evidence of that from the insulin perspective, so that's great. I also want to ask, in terms of having a high total cholesterol, what's the ratio of HDL to total? Because there's been some research on HDL to total that shows that 4 or greater significantly increases cardiovascular disease risk by a lot. Now, we see the ratio here of total cholesterol to HDL is 6.6. So greater than 4 increases it, greater than 5 increases it a lot, and we see it's 6.6 in this case. So that would be a significant increased risk potential for cardiovascular disease. If we do not have an ApoB or an LDL-C, which are the preferred markers for determining cardiovascular disease risk, a cholesterol to HDL ratio is the most researched of the risk factors based on this information that we have here. So cholesterol HDL-C ratio is showing in this case a high risk, very high risk, much higher than I would be comfortable with. So in this case, I'm already thinking in my mind about a recommendation for, if not statin medication, then red rice yeast and probably statin medication. Just this isn't something I want to recommend much at all for people, but this is an extreme example where a lot of people with familial hypercholesterolemia, depending on how many of the DNA changes they have, will die really early in life, sometimes less than 30 years old. And this is not as severe. People can go into cholesterol levels of 400 and above, but this is putting a significant risk. The way that the atherosclerotic process goes is there's a gradient-driven process, and the more particles there are, the more likely they are to collide with the cell wall, just like the more cars on the freeway, the more likely there is to be an accident. And when it collides with the cell wall, that creates an environment ripe for inflammation and oxidation. Once those occur, plaque formation can occur, and that can be a big problem in a serious way. So another question here is, there's also a ratio between triglyceride to HDL. Would I think of this ratio close to 1? So triglyceride to HDL ratio is helpful to some degree, but it doesn't have the research in terms of the cardiovascular disease risk, but it is, you know, it's helpful in assessing for likelihood of fatty liver disease, especially, and fatty liver disease can contribute to cholesterol issues. So, you know, if someone has fatty liver and, you know, especially if they're overweight, you're asking about overweight, especially if they're overweight, that is really, really important to deal with. And in fact, if there's fatty liver and we're treating fatty liver, triglycerides in this case aren't so bad. They're less than 100. I like to see triglycerides less than 100. So in this case, with triglycerides less than 100, I'm thinking it to be less likely there's fatty liver, especially if she's normal weight. Not sure based on the information so far if she's normal weight or not. But assuming she's normal weight, then I'd be less concerned about fatty liver. Although, you know, if there is fatty liver, and let's imagine a different situation, we're clearing out that fatty liver, we're using a lot of choline, which is really important in the case of fatty liver, and we're minimizing, you know, we're doing a dietary approach that's helpful in eliminating that. We're restricting carbohydrates, we're restricting calories, we're restricting fats some in that case, then we might see that that fatty liver would start to go away. When fatty liver starts to go away and the liver breaks down fat stores, that can actually increase cholesterol temporarily, but that increase in cholesterol is good if triglycerides are going down at the same time and fatty liver is breaking down. Now, there's a question about, was alcohol intake mentioned? I don't remember alcohol intake mentioned here, so I'm not sure. But yes, of course, we want to consider fatty liver, we want to consider metabolic syndrome, we want to consider the impact of alcohol, it doesn't seem like those are impactful at this time in this case. So now we want to look at ferritin and iron. And what I'll say about ferritin and iron is there's more risk from high than low in a cardiovascular disease risk case. So from the cardiovascular perspective, that low ferritin and that low normal, or actually mid-range iron, with a low normal iron saturation is preferable to a really, really high ferritin and an iron overload situation. Now, ferritin of 12 is pretty low, so in this case, it probably would be helpful to encourage some consumption of high iron foods. And so, you know, we can look at that potentially iron supplementation, but when I look at iron, I want to look at MCV, MCH, MCHC, and I want to see, are they normal? So we're not seeing signs of anemia in the red blood cells, even though we're seeing ferritin low. In most cases, raising ferritin probably would be helpful in this case, so I would recommend dietary approaches for increasing iron. So adding in some shellfish, adding in some things like beef and lamb, which we're going to have a caveat about in a moment, but those can be helpful in terms of ferritin levels. So typically, when we have cholesterol like this, with the cholesterol HDLC ratio like this, and the non-HDL and the LDL as high as they are, we're lucky to have hsCRP being normal, because if we're adding or compounding inflammation on here, that would make it much higher disease risk. I would like to have also an LPPLA2 marker, would be great, and I don't see one on here, but if we had that, that would be helpful, because LPPLA2 is going to be specific oxidative stress marker for / inflammation marker for cardiovascular specifically. So that would be another test to consider in this case, is to consider a LPPLA2 marker. So let's take a little note on and then we already, I think you already said, we're waiting on an ApoB, which is great. And then an LP little a would also be helpful in this case. LPPLA2 is a little more inflammatory related. LP little a is really a little more oxidatively related. And ApoB is the total particle count that's going to show the number one, or it doesn't matter which, or LDLP, which is LDL particle count. Either one of those is going to be the number one risk factor for cardiovascular disease. And yes, hemoglobin A1C would also be helpful to get a little more on the blood sugar side of things. We see homocysteine is elevated, and that is an inflammatory marker, and that is showing the potential for there to be some methylation issue and or B12 deficiency and or B6 deficiency and or folate deficiency and or B2 deficiency. So, and or choline deficiency. So what we're going to look at here is for homocysteine, we want to make sure that we're looking at B12, B6, folate, B2, and choline. These are going to be the big ones we're going to look at. We may also want to look at MTHFR as a genetic marker. And a serum B12. could be helpful. Urine methylmalonic acid could be helpful. So those would be some labs to gather a little bit more information. Glutathione, reduced glutathione could be possible, probably not necessary. And none of these labs are entirely necessary, but they would be a little helpful. Urine methylmalonic acid is going to give a B12 measure and be a little more sensitive even than serum B12. Serum B12 is helpful, and then MTHFR looks at the enzyme that methylates folate. If there's an MTHFR mutation or multiple mutations, then the same stuff applies. So you can really treat it by a good B complex plus double the choline in the diet. So, you know, you use a good pre-methylated B complex. So we're going to look at so a methyl B complex, something like Active B by Zymogen is a great one. That's the one we use in our clinic. So a methylated B complex. Choline is something that you can get from diet or supplements. And from diet, you can do eggs, which egg yolks are the best source of choline. Now you may be thinking in this case, well, an egg yolk has a lot of cholesterol in it. Would it be a good idea in this case? So the deal with cholesterol, dietary cholesterol and familial hypercholesterolemia is that cholesterol reduction may help in hyperabsorbers of cholesterol. In my personal clinical experience, I've seen a lot of people who don't respond to dietary cholesterol restriction. And in those cases, the nutrient benefits of something like egg yolks may be outweighing any possible contribution of dietary cholesterol. That being said, there are some hyperabsorbers, and it can be worth an experiment of cholesterol reduction in the diet to see if that helps. And usually, what I've seen help more in most cases is actually not restricting cholesterol, but instead restricting saturated fat. Now, saturated fat, of course, on average, for most people, does increase cholesterol, but it proportionately increases HDL and LDL, and it's not associated on average with increased cardiovascular disease risk. We're not talking about averages here. We're talking about someone with familial hypercholesterolemia. In that case, saturated fat reduction, I believe to be one of the best dietary interventions. And that is going to be really, really helpful. One of the most helpful dietary interventions that can be done. We have a question about what about adding more fiber to the diet and or the right type of fiber? Can this be used as a therapy for elevated cholesterol? Absolutely, adding fiber can be helpful, and it depends again on whether there's a metabolic association. If we see more of a metabolic association, raised hemoglobin A1C, elevated fasting glucose, elevating fasting insulin, high iron markers, that's going to be a situation where high fiber is going to be even more important because it's going to slow that blood sugar response and help. So But that being said, direct help with cholesterol can be also one of the fiber supplements that I'll sometimes use in high cholesterol are PGX granules or Konjac fiber. So Optifiber Lean by Zymogen or PGX granules or PGX gel caps, although I don't like the PGX gel caps in this case because they have the MCT oil in them, which is, you know, in it's a medium chain triglyceride, and I want to avoid even medium chain triglycerides in this case with familial hypercholesterolemia. And yes, certain types of fiber can bind fats, so the PGX granules are helpful there. And then the so PGX granules are Optifiber Lean, and then another good one can be there's a certain form of chitosan that can bind fats pretty well too. So on the supplement considerations, I would say we could add in PGX granules. We can add in chitosan. So restricting saturated fat and overall fat, favoring monounsaturated fats when eating fat, and overall about 20% fat in the diet in this case. So most important, avoid saturated fats. Second most important is, of the fats that a person's having, make sure that monounsaturated fats are the majority. That's going to be olive oil, avocado oil are going to be your big monounsaturated fats. High oleic sunflower and safflower oil, but not regular sunflower and safflower oil, only high oleic, are going to be good fat choices. Avocados themselves are going to be a good fat choice. Macadamia nuts and macadamia nut oil is going to be a good monounsaturated fat choice. And then avoiding primarily saturated fats, but also avoiding too many polyunsaturated fats. Even though polyunsaturated fats can lower cholesterol, the way they do it, I don't believe actually will decrease cardiovascular disease risk, and it may increase it. So I recommend avoiding polyunsaturated fatty acid that are, you know, oils that are really, really high in those, but omega-3 fatty acids, of course, are helpful in the diet, as well as some of the monounsaturated fatty acids from olive oil and avocado oil and macadamia nut oil. And macadamia nuts and avocados are also going to be helpful and good in this case. So overall, trying to restrict fat to about 20% of the diet, especially in a case here where blood sugar doesn't seem to be as much of a concern, we can limit fat a little more in this case, and that's going to be really, really helpful as well. And then working on the gut is going to be really helpful. There are a lot of things that can be done in the gut that can help with cholesterol levels. And a person who has issues with their LDL receptor, they're not going to probably completely stop making high levels of cholesterol in the blood. They're going to probably have higher cardiovascular disease risk. But testing for and sorting out issues like small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, like small intestinal fungal overgrowth, like parasite infections, and then really working on repopulating healthy probiotics and prebiotics are going to be potentially helpful in this case. So it would be helpful to have a good lactobacillus bifido blend of probiotics. So that would be helpful to add in. in this case, so we would think about probiotics in this case. Now, in terms of protein, we could go as high as 1 gram protein per pound of body weight. That's fairly high in protein, but as long as there's not, I don't see any signs of kidney issues. And even if there were signs of kidney issues, there are ways to help to negate the negative effect that protein can have on chronic kidney disease. So in this case, I'm going to say about 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight. And then the rest are going to come from fruits and vegetables are going to be the primary source, and gluten-free grains for and or legumes for carbohydrate sources. You could go off of grains entirely, but I don't think that's necessary. I like the Mediterranean style diet. I would recommend gluten-free, probably, since gut can be involved, unless we've done some testing and she really knows she tolerates it. Otherwise, I'd suggest, especially with the symptoms going on, it's gluten-free, possibly grain-free, possibly not, and that we focus on fruits and vegetables with seeds would be fine, and some potential addition of maybe some legumes and beans, especially for the fiber content, to get some good healthy fibers in the diet, like lentils, for example. Then I would recommend getting eggs for egg yolks. So we could do trial of low cholesterol diet, but if not helpful, and you could also wait to do the trial on that and do the fat trial first. If not helpful, don't worry about cholesterol content in food so much. And the reason is that egg yolks for choline are really, really helpful, especially in the context of the high homocysteine, probably relating to a methylation issue. And 15.4 is pretty high on homocysteine. Disease risk starts when homocysteine goes above about 7. And we have cardiovascular disease risk, as well as dementia, Alzheimer's associated with elevated homocysteine. So we want to get a pre-methylated B complex that's going to have some methylcobalamin, it's going to have some methylfolate. I'm not a big fan of huge high doses of methylfolate for methylation issues. I don't like those 1 gram doses, those 5 gram doses. I don't have time to go into the full spiel on methylation, but know that it's the when we do the math on the way methylfolate donates methyl groups into the homocysteine cycle, it would be futile to try to use premethylated folate to get those methyl groups in. I like a little bit of premethylated folate, something like 400 micrograms, but not anything more than that. B2 has been much better researched to actually reverse the MTHFR problems that have been researched. So riboflavin in adequate quantities. So I'd want some riboflavin in the B complex that we're having. And so some methylcobalamin, some P5P would be the preferred form of vitamin B6. So something like active B by Zymogen is going to have methylfolate. It's going to have some B6. It's going to have some methylcobalamin. And it's going to have the nice quantities of those, adequate quantities of those, except for maybe B12. We might need a sublingual B12 and or B12 injection in some cases, especially if metabolism of B12 is subpar. In some cases, there's going to be a real issue with B12 from antiparietal cell antibodies. So I'll add that into the testing recommendation to see if she's not producing stomach acid and or intrinsic factor, which would be causing an issue with antiparietal cell antibodies. So we have a question. How long would you do trial diets before retesting? You're going to want at least 2 weeks on a trial diet before retesting. And sometimes it's, you know, tough for a person to retest in 2 weeks. So I might go as long as 2 to 3 months on a trial diet. I'm pretty confident in the restricted saturated fat in a familial hypercholesterolemia case. So I don't need to test that as much, but the low cholesterol, I would probably give that 6 weeks if we're going to do a trial diet on low cholesterol to give it a fair trial. So I do 6 to 8 weeks retest if we're going a very low cholesterol diet, so no eggs and no butter or ghee, which you're not going to do butter or ghee anyway because they're saturated fats. And then you might avoid red meats and choose only lean meats. But in her case, my leaning is to first go with not restricting cholesterol because I really want that choline for the homocysteine purpose. And I would like the red meat for the purpose of the iron content of it. And we could do a cholesterol restriction in the diet by getting iron from something like clam and eliminating eggs and doing a choline supplement like sunflower lecithin, for example, or a straight phosphatidylcholine supplement. So those would be options. That would be an option. So we could go either way. My leaning would be to probably first try restricted saturated fat, overall fat about 20% of the diet, a gram of protein per pound of body weight, adequate dietary fiber, and lots of brightly colored fruits and vegetables, lots and lots of dark leafy greens, lots and lots of sulfur-rich vegetables like cruciferous vegetables, onions, asparagus, mushrooms, garlic, lots and lots of all those things to really focus on a dietary approach here in this case. And some whey protein would be fine. Some collagen protein would be great as well. Glycine is also helpful in methylation. So a collagen protein or a glycine supplement I would also recommend in this case. So, and genetic testing, we have a question about genetic testing. Yes, I already put MTHFR there. I would add in addition to MTHFR, ApoB, because that's one that's related to cardiovascular disease risk and Alzheimer's risk. My guess is there might be a 4-3 or 4-4 ApoB type in this case, and there may be an MTHFR mutation, one or more homozygous or heterozygous mutations in this case. So that's something to look at. It looks like we did get a fasting glucose of 79, and with a fasting insulin of 5, those two markers look really, really good. So again, on the glycemic side of things, I'm not quite as concerned. So here in this case, we'll really not be too concerned about going with that low fat content in terms of blood sugar impact. We have this carbon dioxide value coming in a little low at 19. For that, I like to recommend people do Buteyko breathing. Buteyko breathing, you can find free online YouTube videos describing how to do Buteyko breathing. So that's something to consider, is sending someone some links or asking them to watch some links on Buteyko breathing. So running out of side space here, but we'll go Buteyko breathing so you have the spelling. So Buteyko breathing can be helpful to build carbon dioxide levels up And so that may be helpful in this case. Then we have creatinine looks normal, glomerular filtration rate normal, sodium is low normal, potassium is low normal. I wonder here, well, chloride is mid-range. Okay, so, you know, with potassium at 4.1, there's a slight increase of cardiovascular disease risk for potassium under 4.5. And since we're so focused and concerned about cardiovascular disease risk in this case, I am interested in increasing potassium, ideally through dietary, but maybe through diet and a combination of diet and supplements would be okay here to get that potassium serum level up to 4.5 or greater. 4.5 to 5 really is the ideal spot for that. No IV or injection potassium. Those, you have to really, really be cautious. They have possibility of inducing cardiovascular issues. But oral potassium through food is completely safe, and through supplements is probably safe as well. So potassium citrate as a powder is my favorite potassium supplement. And I might do something like a quarter teaspoon with each meal, two or three times a day. Could do a half teaspoon twice a day, especially if blood pressure is high. And I'd cut it with a little glycine because it doesn't taste good. Mix it with water and drink it slowly throughout the meal. You can sprinkle it on food, but a lot of people don't like the taste. So I would look at high potassium foods. So lots of fruits and vegetables. Avocados are going to be a great source. They're going to have good fibers. They're going to have the right kind of fat, but not too much of them because they are very fatty. And then plantains are going to be good. White potato would be fine. That's a root vegetable. That's going to get some of the carbohydrate source. So I would say white potato would be good. Sweet potato would be good. And plantain would be good. And then lots of brightly colored fruits and vegetables. And there may be able to be enough potassium just from diet if she's willing to do all that. Then we have liver markers look normal. TSH is in range. That is something that is extremely important to check on because thyroid hormone will stimulate LDL receptors. So if there are LDL receptor problems, we need adequate thyroid hormone. Now, I'd prefer, of course, if we got a little more thyroid data than just TSH, free T4, and thyroglobulin antibodies and thyroid peroxidase antibodies. That's a good start. It'd be nice if we had a free T3 as well. The free T4 is in the low normal for free T4. The TSH is completely normal. So I would look at a multi-mineral to give the zinc and selenium and the backbones, zinc, selenium, and I'd make sure that more iron is available through food or a supplement so that we're getting the backbones that the thyroid needs to produce adequate thyroid hormone. I would also make sure to have a small dose of iodine, especially if she's not having dairy or seaweed or iodized sea salt. Then I would make sure to have at least 150 micrograms of iodine. So what I'm going to do here is go through the rest of this lab, and then I'm going to switch over to a document where we can go in a little more detail here on a protocol. We did get LP little a already, and that's 28, so that's great. So we actually can eliminate this from the recommendation.
Looking for Insecure on the iTunes Store.
Okay, cortisol came in normal. DHEA 171 looks really good. Vitamin D came in at 32, that's a little low. If we had parathyroid hormone, we could say a little more about that, but probably we're going to want a vitamin D K2 supplement in this case. K2 is going to be really important here. It looks like we have hemoglobin A1C pending already. We have reverse T3 pending. We have ApoB pending. And we have methylmalonic acid, at least in the serum, pending. So that's great. We have some good testing on its way. And this is a repeat. Okay, so let's get real specific here. So let's go. Let's go to the whiteboard. Actually, rather than the whiteboard, I'm going to go into a blank document. Be just a little easier for me there. And there's a question about magnesium for thyroid. Magnesium is just a reasonable idea for a whole host and variety of body systems. So I would look at magnesium. So we have familial FH client, familial hypercholesterolemia client, female, 32 years old. And we have total cholesterol, 298. And LDL 233, HDL, I don't remember what HDL is, 50 something. But anyway, we're really looking at protocol here. Yes, I have a question about CoQ10. Absolutely gonna have CoQ10 in the recommendation list for antioxidant reasons, and especially if we're going to do red rice yeast and or a statin drug, then that interferes with CoQ10. So we're gonna wanna for sure supplement in that case. So let's look at supplement protocol. And here we're gonna do we're going to do a table. So we're going to go supplement. I'm going to go breakfast, lunch, dinner, before bed. I'm going to make this bigger. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to look at the order of importance in terms of supplements here, the things that are going to be most critical. So we're really going to want to, you know, the cholesterol and the cardiovascular disease risk is the big thing we're working with here. So we're going to want to make sure to target that with most of our supplementation. And I am going to argue in this case, even though I don't normally like to, but because we're dealing with familial hypercholesterolemia, I'm going to say, you know, red rice yeast here is going to be the most important. Now, that's if she's insistent still on not taking a statin. Taking a statin would be another way to get a similar compound. Red rice yeast is a very similar compound to statin medication. So I would go for 900 milligrams twice a day, at least. That would be a good starting point in this case. That means we need CoQ10 in the form of ubiquinol would be ideal, and we'll do 200 milligrams with breakfast in this case to help replenish that from the depletion from the red rice yeast, also for its antioxidative component, which is going to be really, really helpful as well. Then we're going to want to do pantothene. And pantothene is really nice because it's going to be helpful for reducing cholesterol from a different mechanism. And the different mechanism is probably related to coenzyme A. The cardiometabolic module goes over pantothene and what it does, but it's a little bit of a mystery exactly how it works. So we know that it works from research, but it takes a while. And so this is really a year-long supplement that is going to be really, really a long time. So I'm going to say pantothene, we're going to want to go 450 milligrams twice a day on that. Then we're going to want to include annatto-tocotrienols, and that's going to be 150 milligrams with dinner. And we could go up to 300 on that, but we'll start with 150 there on that. And that's a good starting dose for the annatto-tocotrienols. Those are going to be high gamma, about 90% gamma, 10% delta vitamin E, but we're not going to use the alpha portion of vitamin E. Now, if we did use the alpha portion, we could just, I wouldn't go above 15 IU probably, or, you know, maybe 20 IU, but none of this 40 IU, 400. I mean, sometimes it goes really, really high. So I would be totally comfortable with 10 IU of vitamin E from alpha tocopherol, but really my main target for lowering cholesterol is with the annatto-tocotrienols, and that's going to be with 150 milligrams with dinner. In this case, we're also going to want to look at some glutathione, and we can do 500 milligrams with breakfast and dinner. That can be oral glutathione or liposomal. If it's liposomal, we can go lower dose than this. So we might go 200 milligrams if it's liposomal instead of 500 milligrams. If it's oral, 500 milligrams would be a reasonable dose. So Protocol for Life Balance has an oral glutathione that works well. Annatto-tocotrienols, the Designs for Health, has a good one that works well. On glutathione, you can use S-acetyl. Zymogen has one of those that works well, or liposomal. Quicksilver has one of those that work well for the liposomal side of things. The pantothene, Protocol for Life Balance, carries ubiquinol. Protocol for Life Balance has a good price on that. Zymogen's great for ubiquinol at 200 milligrams in one capsule, so both of those are great options. Red rice yeast, you want to make sure that you get a quality one that's free. There's a constituent that can be in some red rice yeast that's problematic. So you want to either use, Thorn or Designs for Health or Zymogen all have are free of that negative constituent. So those would be decent brands to use for your red rice yeast. Then we're going to want, in this case, a multi-mineral. So I like Minrex. Minrex is one that is a multi-mineral that has trace minerals in great forms. It does have a little bit of calcium in it, but since a lot of people, you know, I'm guessing this woman has a pretty clean diet and maybe limiting dairy. I don't know that for sure, but if she is limiting dairy, then there may be benefit to adding extra calcium, but we have to make sure vitamin D and K2 are sorted out if we are going to add a little extra calcium. So Minrex would be having a little bit of magnesium as well. I would do one cap twice daily as a starting point on Minrex for those thyroid nutrients. It's going to cover the iodine, it's going to cover the zinc, it's going to cover the selenium, it's going to cover some of the magnesium, it's going to cover a little bit of calcium, it's going to cover some of the other trace minerals and cover the bases there. Then I think we're going to want some Let's see what else. We're going to want in this case, we could use berberine to lower blood, to lower cholesterol, especially if there is a gut thing. It might be extra helpful. And we don't know if there's a gut thing yet. I'd encourage a little bit of gut testing first, but yeah, I'm just going to put berberine question mark. And the reason it's a question mark, we don't see high blood sugar. If we did, it would be a definite. So we may want to use it, especially if there's a gut issue. But from the blood sugar perspective, we don't need it. So I'm putting a question mark by berberine for that reason alone. Then we want to look at a nice antioxidant. I like grape seed extract or pycnogenol. And if it's grape seed extract, 250 milligrams once a day. If it's pycnogenol, 100 milligrams. So that would be a good addition. We definitely want the B active. In fact, the B active is up here in terms of its or a methylated B complex. We want one cap once a day of that. That's going to help deal with the homocysteine. That's going to help cover some bases in terms of B vitamins. It'll be really, really helpful. Things like polycosanol could be helpful, especially if there is a hyperabsorber of cholesterol. So that would be another question mark. And it's a question mark because we don't know if she's a high absorber of cholesterol, and I'm not sure whether that would be helpful or not, but polycosanol would be another thing to consider. 20 milligrams once or twice a day would be great. If she's not doing eggs, then we want a choline supplement. And that could be lecithin, like sunflower lecithin, or it could be phosphatidylcholine, could be lecithin granules from non-GMO or from sunflower. There's sunflower lecithin liquids and gel caps. So those are all options. If not, getting choline from eggs and or liver is another source of choline in the diet. Let's check what else here. So vitamin DK2. We might have something like 5,000 IU of D3 and 100 micrograms K2. That would be a decent dose. One, it might even be better to go a little higher in K2. We could go up to 300 micrograms K2. It depends if it's MK7 or MK4. This would be MK7. So we'll say 100 micrograms plus, or so 100 micrograms or more, vitamin K2. You can get a combined supplement that'll have both of those in it. Then we're going to talk about diet. So we're going to go minimize as much as possible saturated fats, and that's including coconut oil, grass-fed butter, ghee, things that would be good for most people. In this case, we want to minimize those as much as possible, and any coconut products. Low PUFAs, low polyunsaturated fatty acids, favor MUFAs, monounsaturated fatty acids, like olive oil, macadamia nut oil, avocado oil, high oleic sunflower, safflower oil, but not regular. So it has to be high oleic to be high MUFA. And whole avocados and macadamia nuts. We're going to recommend macadamia nut milk is a good milk to have. You know, dairy fat is reasonably high in saturated fat, so minimizing dairy is a good a reasonable choice here, just because of that saturated fat content. And then total of about 20% of calories in diet from fat. Protein, about 1 gram per pound of body weight. And that's if she's not overweight. And then we'll say 3 to 5 cups brightly colored fruits and veggies. 3 to 5 cups dark leafy greens. 3 to 5 cups sulfur-rich vegetables. Cruciferous, asparagus, mushroom, onion, garlic, etc. We want 8 ounces pomegranate juice per day. That's a very strong antioxidant. The polyphenols are really helpful in building good gut bacteria. It has been researched to increase blood flow. It's a really, really helpful supplement, or, well, I mean, it's kind of like a supplement. It's very, very potent cardiovascular tonic. So I would treat it like a supplement, you know, diligently, regularly take it. You can get big things of palm from Costco, so that's one option, or from the health food store, you can get 100% pomegranate juice. Just make sure no added sweeteners, of course. So that is the consideration in this case. What brand of lecithin made from sunflower? So Now brand has some sunflower lecithin caps and also liquid. The liquid can be hard for a lot of people to take unless they're mixing it in smoothies. If they're mixing it in smoothies, that's great. If not, then probably the caps are easier. So that would be the sunflower lecithin that I know of. It's possible to get phosphatidylcholine in liquid and in powders from places like Zymogen and Designs for Health. They get pretty expensive in liquids. The powder's a little better, but the Designs for Health phosphatidylcholine powder comes from soy. It is non-GMO. So if someone's okay with that, then that can be an option as well. So you have 8 ounces pomegranate juice per day. That's going to be helpful in this case. And then we want 1 to 2 pounds cold water fatty fish that are low mercury. So that's going to be wild salmon, sardines, herring, mackerel are going to be good go-to choices. Halibut's okay. It's got not quite as much, but it's a reasonable choice. I recommend the cold water fatty fish over the walnuts, walnut oil, flax seeds, chia seeds. I don't think there's anything wrong with those. It's just that the conversion in the liver can be poor. And what we really want to make sure is there's adequate DHA. So DHA is going to be the main thing that we're wanting to get enough of in this case. So that's what we're going to favor. But be fine, of course, to have some flaxseed or flaxseed oil or chia seed. You know, those are fine things. They can get some good fiber too. And then we also want some high iron foods. That's going to be shellfish, especially clam is super high. Beef, lamb, and liver. Those are going to be the high iron foods. Now, we're going to want lean as possible. So 90% plus lean on our beef is going to be important. Lamb can be kind of fatty, so we want to maybe limit that. Bison can be lean, so that would be a good one for, rather than lamb. So liver for iron and choline and B vitamins. And then we're going to look at some things like possible supplement additions would be PGX granules. And we could do like one scoop 30 minutes before each meal. And we could look at Edison as well. I don't know that we need both. If we have one fiber that's also a binder, that might be enough. But we could, you know, potentially do like a chitosan. That would be another option. I'll put those under possible additions. And then labs, I'd really recommend CIMT, carotid intima media thickness ultrasound. So I would really recommend that to look at plaque formation on the carotid and or calcium score. One of those two is going to be really, really helpful to get a sense for to what degree is plaque actively being made with that cholesterol. If it's actively being made, then we really want to be more aggressive with treatment in this case. So that would be a really great test. And I have a question. Do I write out these details for each patient who works with me or some of this? I'll write out some of this. Our health coach will do some of this with people on the dietary front so that we're divided in terms of time, because this can be pretty time consuming. As you see, we're going in a lot of detail here. And the reason I'm going in a lot of detail here is I want you to really, really thoroughly understand how to put together a comprehensive plan. I'm explaining more to you about my thought process than I would with a client, but I will go over some of this with them. I'll certainly put together a supplement protocol. I'll certainly talk about what the significance and importance of the risk that they're dealing with. And I'll certainly make sure they understand what treatments are for what reasons. And then I'll make sure to write out their supplement protocol. I'll write out or have our health coach write out the dietary recommendations. And then we'll also talk through mindfulness recommendations, and then we'll just place the lab order for them. So CIMT ultrasound and or calcium score, ApoB and MTHFR genetic test might be helpful. We're already getting an ApoB gut testing like SIBO and GI MAP or CDSA with parasitology 3 sample test would be a great one to get. And so either one of those would be good. Both of those would be good. And free T3 would be nice. Serum B12. It looked like a methylmalonic acid was on its way. So that's pretty good. That may suffice. Those are going to be the big, huge ones. You know, we could dive into chronic infections because LDL particles do have receptor sites for LPS, lipopolysaccharide, on them. And if there's not a gut infection, then I would dig deeper into other chronic infections because that can be a valid reason for cholesterol to go up. So I don't want to push cholesterol down when, you know, it's having a valid reason to be up in a person to take care of an infection. Now, when it's getting up this high, the risk is probably outweighing the benefit, but I do want to look at infections and consider infections in a significant way in this case. So that's something to consider fairly strongly in this case. So here we have a nice supplement protocol. It's, you know, fairly robust, but I put 2 in question marks. So for most people, you know, depending how cost sensitive and how much they want to take, I'd probably, you know, delete these 2. So, you know, if we deleted these 2, then we're dealing with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 if they're eating eggs. So 9 supplements, that's not too bad. That's a reasonable amount to do a comprehensive protocol, especially for something like this. Now, you know, I would have a conversation about the seriousness of this, and if it doesn't change within 3 months in a significant drop, and or if the carotid intermedia thickness is showing a wall thickness really high and some plaque formation that's pretty significant, then I would recommend a statin. I would say, you know, a statin could be done right away in place of the red rice yeast. That would be an option, but either way, we'll want the ubiquinol. And so, you know, that's what I'd be doing in this case if it were me and or one of my loved ones or clients. So that's something that you can do. So this should give you a real comprehensive analysis here, and hopefully this is really helpful for you. So on to the next question. Male 35, high fatigue, brain fog, memory issues, extreme weight loss without dietary changes, and sleep issues. So high fatigue, I'm wondering about thyroid, I'm wondering about B12, I'm wondering about iron, I'm wondering about chronic infections, I'm wondering about toxic burn. There are lots of things that can cause that, gut issues. Brain fog, memory, I'm wondering about gut issues, I'm wondering about mold toxin illness, I'm wondering about inflammation, blood sugar. Extreme weight loss without dietary changes. So I'm wondering about malnutrition and gut issues, primarily with that. Sleep issues, I'm wondering about gut issues with that. So, you know, really looking to gut strongly here. Inability to drive long distances due to fatigue and brain fog, constantly feels like he needs to eat to not be so fatigued all the time. So suspected body-mind relationship, environmental root causes. 2017 panic attack at work, had to leave. Says never fully recovered since then. So stress. Oh, back to last case just briefly. Meditation, big, 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 big thing. Didn't mention it. Should have mentioned it. Meditation every day for sure. That would be helpful. Okay. 2017 panic attack. Now I'm thinking also meditation in this case. Stress being potentially an issue. Cortisol, dysregulation, and or a sympathetic nervous response or sympathetic dominance being an issue. History of abuse of pain pills, 2008, went to prison 3.5 years, would never assume this from meeting him today. Okay. Catheter ablation to heart. Relate symptoms to supplements. But had a situation where he had a big bowl of crawfish, stopped taking IgG powders, bad spell of brain fog, and MSG exposure, blaming supplements. You know, blaming supplements is a common thing. Mostly it's not supplements that cause reactions. Sometimes it is, so you have to definitely consider it. A lot of times it's not, it's happenstance. So coaching and guiding people through how to stop it for a few days, start it back up, see if it was really that. If not, stop. If it's still a second time reaction, stop it for a few days, start at half dose or a quarter dose, see if it's still a reaction. So those sorts of things are going to be really important. Stress, really important here. Undigested pieces of food in his stool, that's also a pointer to gut. Enzymes, he only takes sometimes. Had a conversation, he's improved a little. Urine shows sediment level of 0.1. Indican level was 0. High cortisol and saliva test. Adrenalectomy. 2016. So I'm not sure if he has one adrenal gland or none. He would have to be on medication if he had none, probably even if he had one. Lots of threes for GABA. Okay, so this is a questionnaire looking at GABA, dopamine, acetylcholine, serotonin. So we can take a look at some labs here. Okay, so he had an adrenalectomy. He still has one. Is he on any hydrocortisone or prednisone as a result of only having one? I mean, it's interesting that he only has one in high cortisol on a saliva test. I'm also curious about blood tests, but we'll look at what testing we have. No meds, okay. Okay, looking to testing here. So, I think client A is the right client. So hopefully we have the right test up here. Let me know if this is correct. So we have a glucose of 98. That's a little high, higher than I'd like to see it if he was indeed fasting. But the hemoglobin A1C looks completely normal. So the average of the past 2 months. So not sure if he was fasting or not, but hemoglobin A1C would take precedence over glucose if we only have those two, but you know, we may have an issue there. Uric acid looks normal, that's good. If it was high, that could fit into a metabolic syndrome pattern. Looks like, okay, this is the correct test for the person we're just covering now. Wondering about gluten sensitivity. Someone chimed into the Q&A, so they're wondering about gluten sensitivity. Bun came in low at 9, creatinine normal, bun creatinine ratio normal, sodium came in a little high at 141, potassium 4.5. I start to wonder about dehydration with these markers here. So there could be some level of dehydration present. I don't consider necessarily 141 to be a problem with sodium. This lab seems to think it's high, but I think he probably needs more water is my thought here. Chloride 102, that's fine. Calcium 9.8, fine. Magnesium 2, fine. Probably supplementing, I'm guessing, to get it there. Phosphorus, normal range, but functionally a little high. You know, avoiding some processed foods would be helpful there. CO2, protein, albumin look normal. Globulin 2.2. That's fine. Albumin globulin ratio 2.2. Again, that's not really concerning. I know these are slightly out of functional range. Alk phos normal. Lactate dehydrogenase, a little on the low end of normal. That could relate to low blood sugar. AST normal, ALT normal, GGT normal, bilirubin normal, serum iron in the blood, a little functionally low. I'm not necessarily worried about that, especially since we have a ferritin of 167. I don't want to push iron with that ferritin, and our total iron binding capacity is low normal, which, you know, if anything, would be more indicative of high iron. So I'm not concerned about that serum iron level in what this lab is calling a functionally low range. I think 75 is just fine there. Red blood cells normal. MCV came in a little high, so thinking B12, folate here in this case. Want to look at those. White blood cells, 4.7, functionally a little low there. Monocytes high, wondering about an infection due to monocytes being high. That could be. Eosinophils normal, platelets normal. So we could think maybe chronic viral or bacterial. Triglycerides of low, I'm not super concerned there. Cholesterol a little low, but barely by just a smidge. HDL low, but in the context of that cholesterol, that's fine. Wouldn't mess with that too much. TSH optimal range. T3 low, normal. Free T3, 3, that's normal. Reverse T3, mid-range. Okay, thyroid's not too bad. I think that's fine. Iron saturation, if anything, it's a little low, normal. Vitamin D looks good. Homocysteine's a little high at 9.8. Would like to see that go down. So we're thinking methylation in this case as well. Same things apply. B12 and folate, especially in this case with high MCV, B12 and folate, big, big issue. I think antiparietal cell antibodies would be great to get in this case. And then sublingual B12 and or B12 injections. And then B-complex that includes B12, B6, and some folate would be helpful in this case. So I would use something like B-Active and maybe a sublingual methylcobalamin as well in this case on top of that. And I would make sure to get adequate choline from egg yolks in the diet, 2 to 3 per day, and I would look at getting some glycine from collagen protein and or about 3 grams, 3 times a day of glycine powder. HSDRP normal. Okay, cortisol. Okay, this might be a different test, I'm guessing. No issues there. Also, maybe dehydration with the sodium and potassium in that high normal. Free cortisol, a little high. So I think stress management's huge here. Stress management, B vitamins. And gut. Gut's gonna be huge. And probably enzymes in HCL are good, but we need to identify root issues. So I would suggest SIBO test, stool test, really looking at gut. I would suggest antiparietal cell antibodies if possible. And until we know, adding a bunch of B12. I would not add phosphatidyl serine for high cortisol unless we had a blood test as well. We might at night, since he's not sleeping though, we could do that at night if he's not sleeping. I would look at ashwagandha, I would look at an adaptogenic formula. It's because of the one adrenal gland. So I'd look at an adaptogenic herbal formula, rhodiola, ashwagandha, eleutherococcus, schizandra. I might look at cordyceps in this case to bring energy levels up, look at a B active, look at choline in the diet, look at collagen, look at getting B complex plus sublingual B12 and our B12 injections in this case. And then deep investigation into GI, probably going to need a big antimicrobial protocol is my guess, because there's probably going to be an overgrowth a bacteria or an infection or multiple infections. So we're probably going to need an herbal antimicrobial protocol, and that's potentially going to be really helpful. And then we'll want to make sure to add probiotics as part of that protocol. So when we get some of that testing in, let me know and we can put together a protocol for that. Someone's asking about CBD, hemp oil. Yeah, that could be helpful, or at least worth a try. So CBD might be worth a try in this case. I think for sure we want to do some of the methylation support and gut work. Those are going to be the big, 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 big have to do them kinds of things that'll, you know, move the needle. And then some adaptogenic herbs, meditation, mindfulness practice. Those are going to be the huge, huge overarching ones. So minerals are also helpful when people have a lot of anxiety. So I'd look at a Minrex, one cap twice daily, B active, one cap once daily. I'd look at B12 sublingual, 5,000 micrograms once daily under the tongue dissolved there. I would look at some sort of adaptogenic herbal formula for adrenals. You could do Adrenal Live that has some adrenal glandular in it. I would only do that in the morning. Maybe not do that at all because the anxiety, actually. I'd do the one that contains magnolia would be great in the evening, or just ashwagandha and things like that would be good. So then, we're gonna go a little over. If you have to go, no worries. I just wanna get through some of these. So female age 68, chief complaints are weight, chronic kidney disease, recent diagnosis, family history of kidney disease with mom and sisters, cannot tolerate sulfur veggies, tomatoes, or any fruits except blueberry, nail fungus on big toe, issues with swallowing dry meats. So thinking gut immediately being significant here. And so gut's gonna be huge, diet's gonna be huge. Husband has dementia, seems to be handling it well though. Okay, that's gonna be stressful. Thinks chronic kidney disease is probably genetic. Diagnosis of IBS in the past, so gut clearly. So SIBO test, stool test, both would be helpful in this case. At least one of them, preferably both. Blood labs show elevated glucose, sodium, GI imbalances, T3 levels low, good range of vitamin D, elevated homocysteine function, sediment increased malabsorption, elevated Indican, high thyroid symptoms, and allergy and metabolic symptoms, insomnia medication for staying asleep, statin, levothyroxine. So with a statin, we want to make sure she's taking CoQ10 for sure. And, you know, ideally figure out together with her PCP if that's really necessary. So we want to look at that. Bone loss medication, those don't tend to reduce fracture risk, unfortunately. So we may want to look at bone stuff. Okay, so client B here. Okay, so glucose 102. So definitely want to work on glucose, hemoglobin A1C 5.6. So this looks like a metabolic pattern. We definitely want to reduce both of those. Uric acid 5.4, that's fine. Bun low, creatinine high, bun creatinine ratio, normal sodium. Lab high potassium 4.8, I would not call that high. I like 4.5 to 5 personally. But I'm wondering about dehydration, so I'd be counseling on water intake. Calcium low, normal, I'd consider that okay there. Magnesium, I would consider that okay. Phosphorus, I would consider that okay. CO2, I would consider that okay. Protein, I would consider that okay. Albumin, fine. Globulin, I would consider that okay. Albumin globulin ratio, I'd consider that okay. Alkphos, LDH, AST, ALT, GGT, bilirubin, all normal. Serum iron, I would consider that okay. The context of TIBC being high normal, ferritin being in the normal range, and that's probably fine. You know, maybe a little more iron, but not sure. Hematocrit, MCV, MCH, MCHC. Hemoglobin came in a little low, normal, but I'd consider that fine. Okay. So really, blood sugar is the big thing to work on here, plus the kidney issue, plus the weight is going to be significant. So it's going to be a big dietary intervention. Some supplements would be helpful. Oh, and I got a question about GABA and L-theanine. I'm guessing that's for patient A, the previous one. If so, then yeah, I think that would be a great fit. So then let's see here. So we want, so tests, we really want a SIBO and or stool test here. Those are going to be really important. It would be, I think you mentioned homocysteine, so MTHFR might be helpful in this case. I don't know if this is the same person or a different person, so I'm opening up this other lab here. So let me know if this is the same person. Yes, it is the same person. Okay. So weight's going down, which is great. Body mass index going down, which is great. Waist going down a little bit, which is great. Vitamin D total. I guess we don't have a current one here. B12, 552. That could be okay. It could be a little on the low end, depending on the person. Insulin of 9, like to see that go to 2 to 5 would be great. Free T3 would be great if it went up to between 3 to 4, at least 2.5. 2.4 is a little low there. Free T4 is looking okay, could go up a smidge. So T4, T3 conversion seems a little poor, probably. TSH looks good. It was bad previously, but it's looking better. So making sure all the things like, all those thyroid nutrients, maybe some ashwagandha for T4, T3 conversion as well. AST, ALT look fine. Glucose has been normal some, but it was high most recently. Cholesterol is pretty reasonable. I know she's on a statin though. Okay, so glucose, yep, it's been high sometimes. Oh, ALT has been high sometimes, and AST, so some liver, probably fatty liver. I don't remember triglyceride, what triglycerides. Yeah, they're a little above 100. Could be fatty liver. Sometimes triglycerides are higher with that. Could be another liver issue. Could be a medication, could be something else. I think we already saw this one. Okay. So in this case, we're really going to want to look at the gut. The gut's going to be huge. So test, SIBO under stool. Diet, we're going to want to do some sort of a low-carb approach in this case. We're going to want to look at... we could look at something like a potato diet 3 to 5 days per week. We could look at a low-carb paleo or AIP diet. We could look at a keto diet, although no, not keto with the chronic kidney disease. So scratch keto. We need adequate fiber, especially if protein is a bit higher in the diet. So with chronic kidney disease, protein can be higher if there's adequate fiber in some studies, that it's the when the fiber goes low that the protein has the negative impact. So if we keep fiber high, so at least 25 grams per day, maybe even pushing it a little higher, closer to the 30 to 50 grams per day, we can be pretty safe. Plus, probiotics are going to be really important here in this case as well. So thinking low-carb paleo or AIP and or regular paleo with a potato diet 3 to 5 days per week. Those would be good dietary choices, but making sure either way adequate fiber because of the chronic kidney disease, but testing for SIBO and or stool, if there's SIBO, fiber is going to get a little tricky, but there are certain fibers that can be done like partially hydrolyzed guar gum or acacia fiber, generally well tolerated. So those can be supplemental fibers. Lentils tend to be tolerated pretty well, and they give some fiber and resistant starch. So I think about lentils in the diet. And of course, on the supplement side, we're going to look at probiotics. We're going to look at an antimicrobial protocol if we find things on SIBO or stool. We're going to look at fiber like acacia and or partially hydrolyzed guar gum. We're going to look at NAC, N-acetylcysteine, probably about 1,800 to 2,700 milligrams per day total. We're going to look at carnitine. The NAC and carnitine can be helpful with kidney inflammation. We can look at about 2 grams per day. That can lower thyroid a little bit, so we want to make sure we get some thyroid support. So Minrex, ashwagandha, MedCaps T3 would be an option. Any of those could be helpful in this case. We'll probably look at some berberine in this case, so berbamycin or another berberine supplement to lower those blood sugar levels. And the Minrex is going to help with some of those minerals that help with blood sugar as well. So that would be another one to look at in this case. We're going to want to make sure she's on ubiquinol, about 200 milligrams as well. And so those are going to be some of the starting supplements here that we're going to look at in this case, to see if we can normalize some of the blood sugar and metabolic markers, lower weight, and help with some of these things that are going a little bit off here. Let's see what else we had. Yes, yeah, so suspected, she's on levothyroxine, suspected autoimmune. So autoimmune paleo might be a reasonable one. It could look at vitamin D with K2, could look at K2 alone in higher quantities with the bone density issues. And I would really focus on gut, lots on gut. Okay, when a client presents an issue with SIBO, parasites, virus, retrovirus, mold, parasites, candida, bacteria, heavy metals, what do you do in the order of treatment? No, some protocols overlap, but length of treatment is different, like SIBO and H. pylori, for example. In case of H. pylori, the person has to wait 2 to 3 weeks to retest again, so not botanicals at that time. No, what important to address adrenal, even though thyroid, before a protocol for higher rate of success. So yeah, if there's a lot of stuff going on like this, usually I'll address toxins before infections, and I'll address gut before toxins, usually. Now, these can, you know, sometimes overlap, and I'll do multiple things at a time, but I would look at gut treatment. So I'd look at SIBO, parasites, and mold as the first, SIBO, parasites, mold, and candida as the first things to treat. Those could all be treated together, or it could be phased. So that would be the first. Then I would look at mold second. Then I would look at the viral and bacterial infections. Some of those can clear up. Sometimes some of that works. Some of them will still be an issue. And so I would look at the viral, bacterial, and heavy metals all together after we had done the gut stuff first. So I would overlap the gut stuff. And for retesting on H. pylori, you know, I'd probably just finish off all the gut treatment. H. pylori can be tricky and take a while. So finish off all the gut treatment, get a clean SIBO test, and then look at retesting H. pylori after that. So candida treatment for mercury protocol, before a candida treatment, mercury protocol. Okay, so candida can sequester, so this contradicts a little bit what I said on the heavy metals piece, but mercury is an exception. In the case of mercury, we do want to treat that in the beginning together with the gut issues. And the reason is that candida or yeast can sequester It can sequester. I need to get a plug for my computer, so hold on 1 second. So much like how fat cells and adipose tissue can sequester toxins and metals, so can yeast organisms can sequester mercury. So we want to add chlorella for sure at the very, very beginning. And we may want to add something like cytodetox, which is a very clean, pure form of zeolite that's not contaminated with lead. And or some other metal detox mixes of supplements, MCP, modified citrus pectin, algal complex, Chelex, which has garlic and a couple other things in it. Those are all options. Chlorella is the for sure go-to key thing. So I would be doing 10 to 15 tablets 3 times a day of chlorella 30 minutes before meals right away when there is mercury present and we're also dealing with candida. So I would do that. And yes, removing amalgams is helpful if mercury is testing high, of course. Removing amalgams is usually helpful overall. In some cases, the removal causes or triggers symptoms. So, you know, it needs to be done properly, but it's better usually to be done at some point if it's done properly. And so when doing candida treatment and there's mercury present, it's good to at least start with the mercury binding as you're starting with or before you're starting with the candida killing. Because otherwise you could release some of the mercury that the candida is sequestering as you're killing it off, and that could be toxic to the body. One of the videos mentioned Dr. Mueller found she has a dairy and egg sensitivity, and she was taking a supplement by Zymogen. So Zymogen has an egg immunoglobulin supplement called IG26+. And I believe, so I don't know if she's retested her her IgG to see if that changed, but she is now subjectively noticing less reaction. So it, I believe, did help. The treatment of worms and parasites, should someone start with worms first and then parasites? What about the product Parantel? How many rounds are necessary before someone doesn't see them coming out? Okay, so most worms, people aren't going to see them coming out. Some they can, and I have had someone, you know, pull out a still moving, huge, long worm. That's pretty rare, but it happens. Some people do see them in stool, although a lot of what people think are worms in stool, when, you know, we look at some of the pictures and things, it looks more like mucus. Mucus can get confused for worms. So people may never see any worms coming out in stool. That's why it's nice to have a lab test and not just rely on people's visual, because sometimes people's visual is actually mucus and it doesn't warrant worm treatment. And there's other things like yeast that need to be treated or bacterial overgrowth that need to be treated. So I like a test. DIMAP is great for detecting worms. Genova has a stool test that does some worm detection. So the test for worms is really, really good to have. And then if there is a test for worms, Parantel can be helpful depending on which type of worm. So just make sure it's indicated for the right type of worm and follow the normal medication dose on that. Some people use Fenben. It's not for human use technically. The studies on it have shown safety. I advise people use at your own risk, but some people are open to that. And it's safely used on goats and dogs and just hasn't ever been fully approved on humans, not for any reason that there's been research showing adverse effects in humans, more the opposite. There hasn't been enough safety information. That being said, some people take it even long-term. Many, many anecdotal reports say they've been totally fine. Some people I know personally have used it for worm eradication. So that is something that some people do, but I never, you know, in the clinical practice, I would never recommend it to someone unless they know that it's not intended for human consumption and they themselves want to do it. And then, you know, to do it safely, there's a little trick to it, but it's not, you know, some of the, just following the dog studies are actually pretty reasonable. So that is a little bit about worms. In terms of worm parasite order of treatment, it doesn't really matter. You can do them both simultaneously. You could do one and then the other. Some of the drugs are a little rough on the liver, so you can stagger. Usually worm treatment's short. It's just like 3 days oftentimes, sometimes followed by another round a month or two later, depending on the worm protocol. Is it pinworms? Is it other kinds of worms? So that really just depends. Pin X is an over-the-counter medication. It's really good for pinworms. And last question here, the use of photobiomodulation in our practice, what conditions are we using it for? What results are we getting? So photobiomodulation, it's a great way to use light, low-level light therapy. We're using an intranasal device and a head unit to stimulate the brain, both the dorsal part of the brain and the different lobes of the brain. We're using it for a variety of conditions, especially memory issues, cognitive impairment, and brain or neurologic issues. So anything in that whole genre, we're using it for. We've thought about using it for addiction. We don't have experience with that yet, but it may be helpful because of the, you know, the nasal cavity goes directly to that limbic part of the brain. Intranasal stem cells have been used for addiction in some cases. So I see some promise, but I don't see research yet, and I don't have clinical experience yet on that. And then for people with chronic infections, often there are a neurological component or components, and it can be really, really helpful in those cases. For mold, there's often neurologic components. There's often a sinus infection called multiple antibiotic resistant coagulative negative staph or MARCONs. And so for Lyme and mold, we're using it, especially when there are cognitive changes as part of that process. So, you know, post surgery could be fine. I don't see any reason not to use it after surgery. So that would be fine. So I believe that's all the questions. We've gone a bit over, so we'll wrap it up here. So thank you all so much for asking so many great questions. I'm glad we got a chance to thoroughly cover some of the things, like especially the familial hypercholesterolemia. That's close to my heart because my father passed from a heart attack. I'm continually monitoring and working on my own cholesterol levels, and I don't have those extreme of levels, luckily, but I have family history, so I'm really paying attention to that and monitoring that and making sure to do everything that I can personally in that department. So I'm glad we got to go over that case, and we had some other interesting cases. So I hope you got a lot out of this, and keep up the good work. Keep submitting those cases. Thank you, and have a great evening.